Welcome to Civil Defense Radio with your host, Preston Schlankover. At Civil Defense Radio, we talk about all things related to civil defense. If you go back to episode number 2, we had a professional emergency manager from Maine on the show. Dale Rowley had a lot to say about civil defense and his efforts in building civil defense and community resiliency in his community. This week, we have another emergency manager, Charles Lane, but his job centers around hospitals and the special environment he has within them. In fact, the U.S. government has mandated hospitals be better prepared to a certain minimum, and we will talk about this in a little bit. But let's welcome Charles to the show. How you doing, Charles?
How you doing? Well, Preston, thanks for having me. How are you?
Great. It's a pleasure having you. We met on the phone quite a few months ago, and matter of fact, it was before I really got my show started. You already had a show that had been going for a little bit. You know, we talked a little bit about how to get things going.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, we had been running it for a while, and it was really cool, I think, for me to meet a lot of other people that were getting involved in doing podcasting or had been for a while, because it seems to be such an interesting way that people consume their media anymore. And you know, for me, I think a lot of people that are on the road traveling a lot, it's nice to have some options besides just your normal playlist when you're on the plane or in the car.
Yes. And your show was State of Emergency, right?
Yeah, it was called the State of Emergency Podcast. Initially, when it started, it was, you know, just a friend of mine that had been a colleague in EM, and he was more the frontline response as I was the planning portion. And so we kind of did the interview format, but then a lot of kicking it back and forth between us. And it ran up until May of 2019. And then we've put it on pause for a few months just because of some personal issues and, you know, life gets in the way, but we're hoping to bring it back in the near future.
Well, I hope you do. It was a good podcast.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Sure, man. Can you give us a brief bio of what your background is in emergency management and what got you into the field?
Yeah, so as far as my general background, I've been in healthcare for a little over 12 years, and I've been kind of in emergency management to some form or fashion for that time, as well as what I do now, which I've moved into training and education, pretty much full-time instructing and curriculum development for the new company I'm working for. And so the healthcare piece of it, what got me really involved initially was a lot of the grant funding around chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, explosive, you know, CBRN preparedness for healthcare. So at the time, you know, the grant money was getting everybody revved up for DECON, and, you know, hospitals need to be prepared for terrorist attacks and all this different stuff. So at the time, they were looking for basically anybody with a hazardous materials background to work as an instructor. And oddly enough, I had worked for FedEx, which is big here in Memphis, where I'm based out of, and I'd done hazardous materials handling for them. And so, you know, I kind of raised my hand from the back of the room and said, yeah, hey, you know, I'd love to do it, and got involved with it. Had some great mentors early on that taught me a ton. People that come from the fire service and military. Took several courses initially for Center for Domestic Preparedness, and over time, really got more and more involved in it. Headed that way with my education and, you know, really just my own, I guess, self-paced learning. An opportunity came up back in 2015 to take over as the emergency manager for one of the healthcare systems here in the Memphis area. I took that over, ran it for about 4 years, and have been very blessed in that time to not only run the emergency manager program and do some great things at my former company, but to get to teach with Augusta University and the National Disaster Life Support Foundation, as well as teach at FEMA with the Center for Domestic Preparedness. And now the company I work for, it's called SRP Contractors. It's based in Memphis, and we do continuing education for healthcare clients, as well as commercial and multifamily clients, to basically help them understand where they fit in emergency management response, help them develop their disaster plan. So we're pretty much trying to get trying to get the good word out. But then also a big piece of our company is that we do basically disaster recovery work, emergency response for general contracting. So it's always funny. Sometimes people be like, you're a construction company. And I'm like, well, you know, like we do a lot more than that.
Yeah, recovery takes a lot of construction equipment, doesn't it?
It does. And I think people forget about that big piece that, you know, the recovery phase involves a lot of construction. And, you know, as we like to say, you really want to have the right people in the room, especially for what, you know, we specialize in is that emergency response piece. And, you know, we talk about disasters and emergencies, you know, we always talk about these big scale things, but I think a lot of people forget that, you know, if a sprinkler head busts in your facility and you're dumping gallons of water an hour into your healthcare organization, that's a pretty big disaster on its own.
Oh, yeah.
So we kind of hit it from all angles, but yeah, kind of all over the place, very organic, you know, just kind of came up through the ranks, became interested in it and was very fortunate to have good opportunities to move into it and work with some great people from all over the country and, you know, get opportunities to learn and do, and then, and teach and share.
That's great. You know, emergency management seems like a really burgeoning profession. It seems like there's on LinkedIn, there's announcements all the time for some emergency management skill that's needed here or there.
You know, it's interesting. I've had some conversations recently, and I'm a huge LinkedIn junkie. and I put up a survey recently for healthcare emergency managers, and it's kind of making the rounds and getting shared. And, you know, it's interesting to me that what I've noticed is there's a trend, and you're correct, there it is a rise in it, but it's still trying to be fleshed out. You know, emergency management obviously is very big in the public sector. You know, you have emergency management directors and you have regional healthcare coordinators and public health emergency preparedness. But in the healthcare world, we still kind of sort of tend to be a other duties as assigned when it comes to emergency management. So you'll notice if you go on LinkedIn, you look at jobs, major metropolitan areas, coastal areas will have emergency management specialists, coordinators, maybe a director at healthcare agencies or over a healthcare organization. But a lot of what we still see is, you know, the security director handles emergency preparedness or the facilities director handles it. And there's not a lot of people where you can look. Even here in Memphis, I was the only person at the time with the title of emergency management program manager in a healthcare organization for the entire region.
Wow. That's
and we were the strange. Only system.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I've made contact with our local emergency manager in my county, and he's a fire chief. And so he has two hats, mostly red. And so the hospital system that we have here is a big system, and they have a guy who's dedicated to that. But you're right, he falls under the facilities manager for the hospital system. You know, there's multiple sites in the area.
Yeah, and I think that has a lot of tendency to, you know, go back to what we think about in terms of emergency management, and we forget sometimes that emergency management as we know it is not a very old profession. You know, it's still fairly new, and there's still a lot of thought process around, you know, does the fire department handle it? Does law enforcement handle it? Well, if you've got a terrorism background, you're emergency manager. If you've got a first response background, you can be an emergency manager. And I think people are starting to catch on that it's a much more comprehensive role, and it is a little bit different. And again, that's not to say that a former law enforcement officer, a former fire chief, or whoever can't become an effective emergency manager. There's just a difference, I think, as you're looking now, more and more areas of higher education are issuing, you know, bachelor's degrees, master's degrees, doctorate degrees in emergency management specific courses. Mm-hmm. And it is a very different line of thought than fire service or, you know, potentially like Homeland Security, criminal justice type careers.
Right. Yeah. I've noticed that, in my outreach to communities, trying to get them interested in civil defense. The fire service, they like our county, they don't even have a CERT team here, and he doesn't want one. So that tells you a lot about their mentality. And this, he's not the only one in the area. I've noticed that there's quite a few that seem to not want, let's say, non-professionals other than the volunteer firemen playing around in their soup. And you know, there's kind of a disconnect sometimes with the volunteer side and the professional side. And so that's unfortunate. And I think a fire chief who's doing emergency management should have a lot broader ideas of how things go and try and think out of the box. The FEMA's CERT program is a great program, but I like another one even more, which is the Washington State Emergency Management Agency's program called Map Your Neighborhood. I've talked a lot about that before, but that's a great, you gotta build in blocks, and you know, you go to the lowest common denominator, which is Map Your Neighborhood, and you get people talking in their neighborhood, you know, across the street from each other, and they start coordinating with each other, and then you bring in your CERT team, and you have a core of people that you can recruit from because they're already involved in Map Your Neighborhood. So it's a building process, and then you know, you go farther with the CERT program, and that now becomes civil defense because you're taking it out of the limited role that FEMA has the training for, and you're going into longer term storage of food. You're going into more areas of need during a long term crisis than just the short term response and recovery.
Right. You know, so much of, you know, we talked about this here recently with some students in the class and talking about response and recovery and community involvement. And yeah, I think we forget a lot, even though there's been a bigger press on it lately, I think because of, you know, mass shooting, active assailant type situations, that, you know, there are immediate responders, and those immediate responders are your community, you know, so activities like CERT and Stop the Bleed training. I mean, we seem to forget that CPR, first aid, AED training has been a factor for groups like, you know, American Red Cross for decades. And, you know, how many lives are probably saved every day because somebody learned CPR, you know, exactly, from a school or from a training class. So, you know, I'm a very big proponent of, you know, what Brock Long was talking about when he was at FEMA, and it is that community level preparedness and resilience, because we see this more and more in these complex disasters, that as much as we want to plan and as much as we want to get out there and do our best as first responders and, you know, emergency management agencies and everything else, the problem is that there aren't enough resources to go around for everyone. You can't save everybody. You know, hospitals can't treat every single person that shows up at the door. And there's all these complex issues that surround this. And so anything to me that empowers your everyday citizen to be prepared, to get involved, those are, in my opinion, things that we should be heavily investing in, heavily gearing people towards, not being dismissive of, you know, the everyday person. And I think there's a quote from Margaret Mead, and I can't remember the context in which the quote was given, but she was from Ireland, and there was groups, and she was talking about, basically said, never doubt that an ordinary citizen can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has.
That's great. I like that. Brock, he did a lot of good things at FEMA when he was there. You know, the build a more resilient community was a big mantra of FEMA's for even with the prior administration, but it never got down to the people. And that's the missing element, the people element, the citizen element, the extra leg to that stool. You know, you've got government and business. That's a two-legged stool. They need the third leg, which is the citizenry. And that way it can at least stand up on itself. But you're right, when the citizenry is involved, it's a resource multiplier. It's not a hindrance. Only if you look at it as a hindrance, then you're short-sighted. Should be reason for you to be replaced with somebody who has more insight into what things should be like. And you know, while I'm on the soapbox, there's other threats out there besides active shooter and wind damage and flooding. You know, the normal things. There's more threats out there that people should be aware of. And on this one board that I get onto fairly regularly, I get chastised every time I put something up about EMP. Somebody has to make a snide remark. Well, you know, that just tells me you don't know what you're talking about, because an EMP, to me, who's done the research, is the number one threat to this nation. And can it happen? Yeah. But is it likely to happen? Probably not. But we should at least be aware of it and be aware of the effects that it would cause down, after the bang, so to speak. And so we need to know those so that we can prepare for those, because those are some of the same preparations that need to be made in case we have a solar event, which a solar event is number two on the list.
You know, and what's interesting about that is, I think if you really look at emergency management in general, or emergency planning, if you want to put it in that framework, is everything we deal with is low probability, high impact events. You know, Category 5 hurricanes don't hit the coast once a week.
Right.
But they are out there, and they happen fairly regularly now. We're starting to see more and more intense hurricanes that are hitting and hitting larger areas. I mean, what recently just happened to the Bahamas, you know, it's kind of a sobering reminder. I'm always, when I go back to Katrina and everything else, how quickly the media moves on. Yeah. You know, the Bahamas are completely devastated, will be for some time. And you have to think of not only the long-term just life impacts for the people there and the people who had loved ones there, but the long-term recovery, the impacts to their economy, the impacts to, you know, our economy. When you talk about travel and everything else, I have a friend and a colleague that's a fellow instructor with me that, you know, he sails his boat to the Bahamas all the time, loves the people there, you know, and has been very involved, and he's devastated by this.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And yet, you know, we'll move on to the next. So the problem is we have enough frequency with mass media that, you know, stuff happens, but we tend to get, you know, we have normalcy bias where we say, okay, well,
exactly,
you know, it's not going to happen here, you know, is the mantra. But then you also have to look at these things like EMP and solar flares and, you know, even an attack on the electrical grid, which is something that's been discussed more and more frequently. You know, there's all these things that very well could happen. They just haven't occurred yet.
Exactly.
And what will the impacts be for us? You know,
we did have a physical attack on the power grid in Metcalf Substation outside of San Jose, California, back in, I think it was 2013. Where three guys got in there and used AKs and shot the place up. Some special operators from here in Virginia went out there and looked at it and said, this is typical, pre-planned, pre-staged, because each shooter's position had little markers next to it. And so they knew exactly where to stand, where to shoot. And so it's been done. And then there was a solar event, knocked out the Quebec power. I think it was in the 80s that they got knocked out, and it went down into New York that, you know, lasted for like 8-9 hours, but it's happened. And then 2012, we had a Carrington level event that missed us by a week. So it they're out there.
Right. And, you know, when you think about it too, the things that I think attack our everyday way of life, so to speak, you know, I brought it up this morning at a conference I was presenting at, you know, that we're so attached to our phones and our computers and our tablets and our laptops and all these different pieces of electronics that we don't remember basic things anymore. We don't know, you know, we don't remember phone numbers, and I'm guilty of this. I'm not, you know, trying to preach at anybody. Right. I don't remember phone numbers, but we've forgotten how to do basic things. And so when you have a power outage or you lose access to technology, you know, from the healthcare world, everything is moved to an electronic health record.
Oh yeah.
Everything is digital now. Mm-hmm. So what do you do when you can't access that? And, you know, we going into healthcare again, and it's kind of why we're talking hurricanes and everything else. We talked prior about Hurricane Maria. So a lot of things that we don't think about even initially in the disaster, but then we don't think long-term impacts. So it's easy to be dismissive, and I don't say this to be cold-hearted, but it's easy to be dismissive of a disaster happening somewhere else because you go, well, it's terrible for them, but it didn't happen here. It has no impact on me or my life.
Right.
Until you realize, yes, it does. What a lot of people didn't realize is that when Maria devastated Puerto Rico, a good portion of the U.S.'s supply of IV fluids are manufactured by Baxter. Baxter is in Puerto Rico. So what happened was right as we are getting into one of the worst flu seasons we've had on record, we had a hurricane that devastated the area that supplies a large portion of IV fluids to the United States.
Oh man, that could mean somebody's life down the road.
Right. So it was a huge issue of getting quite literally into crisis standards of care almost immediately because now you're running low on resources. Yeah. We have very sick patients that need fluids and we can't get them. There's a shortage. So at some point you have to go, what do we do? You know, how do we continue to treat these patients? Who gets it? Who doesn't? And, you know, IV fluids are a basic product. We don't look at those as a premium item. We just think, oh, fluids. I need fluids. Okay, let's get them. And when they're not available, this had a huge long-term impact on healthcare preparedness in the United States because now what you see is people are going, okay, we need to have stockpiles on hand. And it was a learning issue for us where we had stockpiles on hand, quickly went through them. And so we're going, okay, we need to realistically look at what do we need to have on hand. And, you know, again, realistically, because these things have an expiration date, it's the same with the strategic national stockpile. Now there are other things we look at.
Right.
At some point you can only store so much before it, you know, it's cost negative, I guess I would say, to hang on to all this stuff and then potentially not use it. And then what do you do with it?
Right. Well, we're going to have to take a quick break and we'll be back in a moment. Hey friends, please allow me to speak with you about something you may want to add to your regular health maintenance routine, as well as your preparedness supplies. A few years ago, I came across an article in a preparedness magazine that caught my attention. My wife and I have always been health conscious, and we have taken various supplements over the years. However, this article introduced us to the world of essential oils. My wife began researching to find a reputable company with high quality products. What she found was a company that we have been with now for about 4 years, using their products, many of them daily. The company is doTERRA, and their products are certified pure, therapeutic-grade essential oils. Essential oils come in all grades on the scale, but doTERRA oils are, in our opinion, at the top. Sure, you can go to Walmart, your local pharmacy, and purchase essential oils, but not many of them are recommended for internal use. Many of our oils can be used orally, topically, and Diffuse for their wonderful aromatic fragrance and health benefits. Some of our favorites we use almost daily are lemon, clove, frankincense, lavender, En Garde blend, peppermint, and melaleuca, also known as tea tree oil. These oils have become our go-to remedies for managing our health throughout the year. In fact, we credit our oils for our overall good health. You can too. Just visit our website at www.oilsforlifetoday. That's oils, number four, lifetoday.com, and explore the wonderful world of certified pure, therapeutic grade essential oils for yourself. And we're back with Charles. So Charles, before the break there, you were mentioning the catastrophe that happened with Maria hitting Puerto Rico. But we, you know, a lot of people, when they think about something bad happening, they think, you know, the hospital's there, it's always going to be there. Well, Puerto Rico, a statistic that I heard once was that there was only one hospital functioning out of 60 in Puerto Rico after Maria hit. That's unbelievable. You know, and then when we talked the very first time, you told me about New Orleans and the hospital that happened there. And then a lot of people have seen the pictures of Joplin, Missouri, of the hospital that was devastated by a tornado. The only thing I haven't seen is, as far as natural disasters go, is a hospital here in the United States that was devastated by an earthquake. I haven't seen anything like that yet, but we've had tornadoes, hurricanes, and and that's pretty much it, right?
Yeah, so, you know, I think we've kind of changed some things, you know, over the years, with especially like California, where earthquakes are still somewhat common, that, you know, we've changed building codes and seismic codes and everything else. But that's always been our fear here in the New Madrid seismic zone around Memphis, St. Louis, you know, those areas, that if we were to have a major earthquake here, how would things fare? And actually, in trying to do some research, you know, I know there's been several, you know, earthquakes overseas that have damaged hospitals, you know, in Indonesia, places like that, where they've, you know, had extensive damage. And I think, you know, probably going back into the, I think the 70s, you know, where they've had earthquakes in California and stuff like that, San Francisco earthquake, San Fernando Valley, just kind of pulling out of my memory. I think those areas, you know, have had hospital damage. But again, you know, what was the age of those hospitals? What codes were they built under? And then, you know, as things are now. But, you know, we are seeing not so much necessarily the impact, direct impact of events on hospitals, but also the, you know, the community impact kind of unloading onto hospitals. And I'll take that in two different directions, because when you look at New Orleans, and also too, I think one of the things we forget about a lot in talking about Katrina is the Mississippi Gulf Coast, which, you know, Gulf Shores, Biloxi, those areas were, you know, completely devastated. There was just nothing left. And then with New Orleans, you know, specifically the book 5 Days at Memorial deals with, you know, the impacts of Hurricane Katrina and the resulting levee breach and everything on Memorial Hospital and the surrounding community. And so there are those situations where an event does impact the hospital, and yet, as they outlined in 5 Days of Memorial, patients still continue to show up to seek care. One of the things that was really kind of mind-blowing to me, but it makes sense, if the average citizen and what they understand about their care is they just know that they need it. If I'm, you know, this or I'm that, I need to go to the hospital. And in 5 Days at Memorial, Dr. Sherry Fink kind of talks about that, you know, that patients showed up to the hospital walking through floodwaters to receive dialysis, to receive chemotherapy. You know, they just knew they needed it, and so I have to make my way to the hospital, which presents its own sort of issues. But then on the flip side, you know, I'll kind of talk about my own personal experience. I was you know, I joke and say I was a baby EM. I'd been in the job 9 months, I think, when it was right before Christmas. It was December 23rd, 2015. We had a large tornado outbreak in the Mid-South and you know, really across the kind of Midwest, but specifically in the Mid-South area, Memphis, Tennessee, Alabama. We had several long track tornadoes that happened throughout the day and into the evening. And we had, when it resulted up, resulted in being an EF4 tornado, a long track through multiple counties in Mississippi and into Tennessee. And one of my hospitals began to rapidly receive patients from the scene. And, you know, we set up incident command structure and, you know, the hospital itself and the surrounding community was completely fine. But a county and two counties over, these people were coming to us for care. And so it was a huge thing to kind of see, one, I couldn't compliment my people and then the community responders enough, because this was, you know, again, this is the night before Christmas Eve. You know, most of your leadership is out, you know, people are out of town and all this. But, you know, large event that occurred really two counties over, but now the hospital is involved because it's still part of your community. And the reason I bring that up is I think that emergency planners really need to look, when you do a HVA, you're doing your assessment, you're doing your vulnerability and your risk and all that. You don't need to just look at, okay, here's my town, here's my community where my building is in. You need to look at what's around you and think about that, because especially the more rural you are, you may be a metro surrounded by multiple counties that you're their resource.
Yeah, yeah, and or the closest resource.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and there's the mobile population that's always, you know, there's always somebody traveling from someplace to your area, and so you have those people that that are potentially going to be in your facility also.
Correct. Perfect example here, you know, we have Elvis Week every year.
Yeah.
People from all over the world, you know, come and they spend time at Graceland, and you know, there's a huge event surrounding that. And, you know, our local EMA, our local healthcare coalitions, Medical Reserve Corps, everybody kind of gets together. And, you know, we've deployed a field hospital in the past. We've been out there to just make sure people are staying hydrated, that, you know, if they need medical care, we can maybe take some of the burden off the hospitals, and that they, you know, they can be seen on site before they have to be transferred to a higher level of care necessarily.
Right.
You know, we found out very quickly, there are people from all over the world that come here, and, you know, some of them speak very little English. Some of them speak no English, but they're traveling with a person who does, and then what happens when they get separated. So, you know, these are all very important planning considerations that you have to look at is, you know, what do you do when you have people from outside of your area that don't understand where to go, you know, as far as directions, they don't understand, you know, we always talk about, you know, don't go to that part of town. And so, well, these people don't know this. So risk communication is a huge part of it,
right.
You know, and planning for your vulnerable populations and people that may be out of town. And, you know, if you're on medication and you travel, you probably take enough to travel with, and
yeah,
then your stock is at home.
Right.
Well, so what happens if you're out and about, you've taken your meds for the day, now you're separated from your hotel, your vehicle, whatever, where are you going to go? You're going to go to a hospital because, you know, I have to take this medication to stay healthy, so I'm going to go to the place that I assume reasonably has it.
Yeah, yeah. We're quickly running out of time here, so I'd like to switch gears and let's talk about real quick about the rule that came out in 2017 that mandates certain levels of preparedness for the healthcare community. Because I'd like everybody to understand that some areas of government have prepared and have set standards, and that's a good thing. We just need to, as individuals, try to meet that same standard or better.
Absolutely. So I'll give you the 30,000 foot view of this. So Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, as we call them in the healthcare world, basically identified 17 different types of providers that receive CMS funding, Medicare or Medicaid funding, and said, you must be compliant with these emergency preparedness standards in order to continue to receive funding. So for the hospital side, we've been dealing with this for several years with, we had to be NIMS compliant, we had to have incident command system compliance, we had to work with a healthcare coalition in order to get grant funding, things like Joint Commission and DNV, you know, were accrediting agencies that had emergency preparedness regulations. NFPA has emergency preparedness regulations. So you have all these things that you already had to be compliant with. But CMS basically said, you know, here's our take on this. Here's how you will comply. We want to see a lot of community involvement. We want to see partnerships, you know, your external stakeholders, community stakeholders. We want to show, we want proof that you're working with these people. And a lot of that came out of, you know, your nursing homes and long-term care facilities not being able to properly evacuate during, you know, disasters and not knowing who to call. You know, it's staggering to me that a lot of people think that they can just pick up the phone and call the National Guard and order water.
It doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen. It's not going to work that way. So the rule, like I said, applied to 17 different provider types. It's hospitals, long-term care, skilled nursing facilities, ambulatory surgical centers, you know, a bunch of different ones. So most of them are familiar with this, but there's tons of templates and all these things out there on the internet, but it's a huge piece that all of these different healthcare organizations are trying to meet that standard, be better prepared so that, you know, regardless of the situation, they can take care of their staff, they can take care of their patients, and, you know, hopefully limit the impact of any events, you know, that come up.
Yeah, but it's not all long-term care facilities or things like that. It's only those who have who are receiving Medicare, Medicaid funding, correct?
Correct, which is, you know, a substantial amount, you know, of these agencies, because for some, that is their, you know, it's a primary source of their funding. So unless an organization is, you know, completely just, you know, private pay, insurance, things like that, if they're taking Medicare or Medicaid, you know, even from one patient, they have to be compliant with this rule in order to continue to receive funds.
Well, I ran into some elder care facilities that are completely private. They don't take any kind of government money, and they didn't know about the rule because it didn't apply to them. But at the right. same time, their standards may or may not be sufficient and equal to the rule.
And that's correct, you know, and that's something that, you know, people need to consider, I think, with anything. And it gets back to our conversation earlier. I'm a big proponent of personal responsibility. You know, at the end of the day, I think you have to be responsible for you, and you have to ask the right questions and know what you're getting into. But, you know, we do need to remove a little bit of this mentality that everybody is going to take care of me. So, you know, my advice on that would be, if you're thinking about transferring a loved one to a level of care such as, you know, private pay, assisted living facility or something like that, ask them what their emergency plans are. You know, ask them, how would you evacuate your building? You know, do you work with community resources? People need to be educated about this stuff, because if they're not aware of the rule, the likelihood that they're plugged in with the local healthcare coalition, emergency operations center, to request resources is probably unlikely.
Yes. So in this last minute, can you, you give us any, final thoughts and, how somebody could get a hold of you if they needed to?
Yeah. So, if anybody wants to get a hold of me, I'm a pretty easy guy to find. I'm on LinkedIn quite frequently. So it's going to be under Chuck Lane, L-A-N-E. And I think you've got the link to my page, but if anybody wants to research me, they'll find me, like I said, my title on there. I'm the Director of Training and Education at SRP Contractors. So I'm pretty well connected with a lot of emergency managers and healthcare folks across the country. So probably a good likelihood if you're listening to the show, I'm second or third connection.
Okay.
Then also our show, State of Emergency Podcast, is hosted on Sitch Radio. But you can find us on Spotify and, you know, Apple Podcasts, all the usual places, and listen to some of the older episodes. Like I said, I'm hoping we'll get that one up and running. But, you know, my final thoughts would just be, you know, do your best to stay prepared. You know, really know if you're in the industry, whether it's healthcare, public, private sector, whatever, know what regulations are out there, know what you need to be compliant with. And don't be afraid to ask for help. There's a lot of resources out there that are free that are just as good. You know, sometimes we think if it's free, it's not good. But there's a lot of stuff out there to educate yourself. And that would be my thing. You know, just be in the know, be educated, and stay prepared.
Great. Thanks a lot, Charles.
Thank you, bro.
Civil defense equals resiliency equals survival. The top-down governmental approach to solve our community resiliency problem has failed us. We need a community-based, grassroots approach to solve this problem. To be resilient, it takes preparation, organization, and training to meet the needs of whatever situation we may find ourselves in. Civil defense helps reduce panic in a disaster, and this is why we strongly recommend establishing a community-based civil defense organization in your city or county in partnership with your local emergency manager and community leaders. Let's start a conversation with a guide found on our resources page at our website on civildefenseradio.com. Be sure to check out our regular postings on Facebook at Civil Defense Radio and on Twitter at civil_def_radio, where we post information about the many threats we see to our safety and security as a nation. I wish to thank Charles again for being on the show, and to thank you, our friends and listeners, who are with us on a regular basis. I really appreciate you being with us this week. So please, be safe, be informed, be prepared, and may God bless you and keep you until next time.